Film Spotting is brought to you by the new PeerFlix.com, a fun place to get movies for less.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And from Milwaukee, I'm Sam Van Halgren. On this week's show, Adam and I try to satisfy our bloodlust by assembling the top five battle scenes in movie history.
And Sam, I'm warning you now, if you include Henry V on your list, I'm going to
gouge your eyes out. Once more into the breach, dear friends.
Don't do it, Sam. Don't do it. Also on the show, Massacre Theater, listener feedback, music from Arcade Fire, and the second film in our six-week silent films marathon, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
But first, we take a quick trip to the Hot Gates and share our thoughts on the blood, sweat, and Spartans of Zack Snyder's 300.
Yours is a fascinating tribe. Even now you are defiant in the face of annihilation. Imagine what horrible fate awaits my enemies when I would gladly kill any of my own men for victory.
And I would die for any one of mine.
Consider the fate of your women.
Clearly you don't know our women. I might as well have marched them up here, judging by what I've seen.
That's Gerard Butler as the very model of a masculine Major General, King Leonidas, exchanging some witty banter with the conspicuously effeminate Persian king, Xerxes, played by Rodrigo Santoro. Sam, it's hard to believe, but it has been almost 2 years since we fought the epic Battle of Sin City here on Film Spotting, and the war wages on as we face another Frank Miller graphic novel adaptation, a loosely based account of the ancient battle at Thermopylae that saw Leonidas' small but formidable band of Spartan soldiers valiantly hold off, or at least impede, Xerxes' invading army. And Sam, you famously, or perhaps infamously, disliked Sin City. In fact, you hated it, calling it disturbing. You felt unfortunately privy to Frank Miller's deepest, darkest secrets, suggesting Miller is a man who hates women and has a fantasy of living out his fears and anxieties through violence. Is this all coming back to you, Sam?
This doesn't sound anything like me.
In summary, you said Miller's world was a place you didn't want to spend any amount of time in. Did 300 also leave you angry and uncomfortable, or has director Zack Snyder successfully redeemed the previous transgression committed by Miller and his Sin City co-director, Robert Rodriguez?
Well, you know, 2 years ago, Adam, you know, when we started this show, we used to start every review by talking about the things we liked about a film, no matter how much we may actually have loathed it. And as I recall, it may have been the very last time we ever did this was with Sin City, where I couldn't help but launch into my vitriol on the film. So I'm going to start, in that tradition, I'm going to start my review of 300 by talking about the things I liked about it. So what did I like about Zack Snyder's 300? I liked everything about 300. I loved this movie. As we talked about last week, when I first saw the trailers for the film, I thought, wow, that's agonizing. I hope we don't have to review that. Then I actually took a look at the original source material, Frank Miller's 300, and was kind of interested in it. I liked it. I was kind of won over by it and got pretty excited about it. Then caught Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead remake, a little underwhelmed. So I went in with kind of modest expectations, still on the more enthusiastic end, but with my expectations curbed a little. And almost from start to finish, I loved this film. I think for the most part, broadly, I liked it because I think it completely succeeded in what it set out to do, and that was to bring to life this centuries-old battle using all the techniques, the current CGI techniques available to them, and really just bring this whole thing to vivid life. And I think not only does he succeed in doing that, Zack Snyder, but he also improves greatly, in fact, on the original source material. I think I would have liked this film under any circumstances. I think I love it because I actually read Frank Miller's original, and I saw the improvements that Zack Snyder made, and I'm really impressed by it. But I'm going to let you jump in here. Are we going to be battling over this? Did you like it as much as I did?
No, we're going to be battling, Sam, and I actually respect you too much as a critic to suggest that you are just trying to compensate for your misguided hatred for Sin City with this hysterical response, but that's what I think it is here. And maybe I would have had a different response if I had read the source material and could have compared them, but if our listeners are hoping for a battle, there's at least the potential for it here. We'll see how it plays out. But, you know, I like a good battle scene as much as the next red-blooded American male, and the first battle scene between the Spartans and the Persians that we see, I thought was just fantastic. I loved the tactical part of the phalanx, learning about how they use their shields. Mm-hmm. The Spartan army uses their shields to protect the soldiers, you know, on either side of them, and then march ahead, and they force back the oncoming army over the cliff. Great stuff. It was not only adrenaline pumping, but inspiring in a way. It was exciting, and the sad part of it is that for me, the rest of the movie never recaptured that magic, that excitement, or builds on it. And I think part of it is that the battle scenes become, for me, incredibly redundant, but also because the movie is oddly, I think, contradictory in that it is very much about storytelling and the use of narratives to inspire, and we get a clue early on what is really happening, which is that we are seeing unfold a story that is actually being told by a narrator.
Yes.
We're hearing the legend of Leonidas that this narrator is using to urge the full Spartan army onto battle. And the problem is that once the fighting starts, the movie pretty much abandons any attempt at actually having a narrative and becomes just a succession of bloody battle scenes. And since pretty much all of the soldiers except Leonidas are anonymous and have no stories whatsoever, and the only one who has any kind of story we know is going to die because he's the only one who's given a story, we don't really care about any of these people or whether they live or die.
You mean you don't care about any of these people, and you whether they live or die. I mm-hmm. did care. I thought they were interesting enough. I liked their whole ideal, the ideal of dying on the battlefield was their ideal. And that was enough for me in terms of understanding their justification. Totally fine. As far as the battle scenes becoming redundant, I totally disagree. The stakes were raised in each and every case in an interesting way and were staged interestingly in every other way. And as far as I really appreciate it. I think they could have done more with the whole bookending of the storytelling.
Yeah.
I liked that. And I think, honestly, that justifies the way this material is presented in this sort of hyper-real, mythological kind of way. I mean, it mm-hmm. is 21st century mythology of, you know, first century reality. And in every case, you can imagine the storyteller embellishing the story, turning these enemies into the monsters they become in terms
right.
of what we see. I love that idea. I love the idea of us sort of seeing myth come to life. And I think Snyder does a great job in doing that. You became bored by the fight scenes. I didn't at all. I really thought they were inventive and fun. This whole use of these kind of three-dimensional blood spatters really, I think, turned the whole thing into art in a way. Pop art, maybe, but art nonetheless. Exciting in the way that, people are going to be mentioning this in the same context as Matrix, whether they were ripping off the Matrix or just improving on it. I think you can't help but think of the Matrix or Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon here in terms of really the visceral excitement of watching these battle scenes. For me, I absolutely put 300 in the same category of those films. I also think in a film that's largely been dismissed as a film that is just about the battle scenes, I think it's exceedingly well cast, really well cast, particularly the lead. Gerard Butler as King Leonidas needs to be the charismatic leader of these men, mm-hmm. and he absolutely is. I loved watching him, and I loved Lena Headey as his wife, Queen Gorgo, who was given a whole sub-story that doesn't exist at all in the original material, which I think is really interesting. She totally deserves it. She's really compelling, and her character is too, and she's great. And it's really like the dialogue is bad Shakespeare.
Yes.
And these actors pull it off. I guarantee you these actors have theatrical training and they just pull it off due to their sheer commitment to the material, which isn't really strong as script, but it works.
I agree with you that the actors pull off the dialogue as best they can. I like both of those performances as well. I think my main beef with the film, and I defy you or any of our listeners to write in, I look forward to the feedback, to tell me that you were truly roused by the film. That by the end of the film, when you're hearing this big speech, that it didn't just lay there on the screen, because I'm telling you, that's the reaction I had. I'm not saying I didn't have a visceral response to some of the great battle scenes. I absolutely did. I found some of it entertaining. After a while, I found it redundant, and then by the time the film ends, I was completely unmoved. And by a story like this, and by a story that is intended to move us, it is about, again, narrative and urging people on to battle, I couldn't believe how lifeless I thought by the end of it it really was. And I know this is an easy criticism of a movie with this kind of visual look to make, but I literally started to feel like I was watching a video game. One of those games like Grand Theft Auto or something where they tried to throw into the game, the action, bits of dialogue, you know, scenes that feel like they're in a movie, and you have these stretches of violence interrupted by really stiff writing and acting. And you know where, you know, again, the kind of video game hero stops shooting someone and goes in and talks to a mob boss or something. That's what I felt like here watching this film. And for being an epic movie and for trying to be this big epic film, it felt really small. And I think that part of the problem is the visual look is that, you know, despite some of the good visuals in those battle scenes, I'm surprised that some of our listeners in our message boards and in responses who are so blown away by the spectacle of just looking at the film. I don't get it. I loved the way Sin City looked, the hyper-reality, and I felt here that 300 seems so determined to translate the page to the screen that that's exactly what I thought I was looking at.
I totally disagree.
Every frame is flat. There's no depth to it. It literally looks like you're looking at a flat page, characters against a flat background. There's a shot of Leonidas at one point climbing rocks that look like paper mache to me. If it weren't for the sound effects, the sound of him climbing the rocks, it would have been totally laughable. And so I didn't even have the pleasure of looking at the film. And, you know, this question some people raise about whether or not you can be too faithful to the original material, the graphic novel. I think Rodriguez with Sin City was faithful to the spirit and the look of the graphic novels while still being cinematic, and I know we disagree about
totally
that.
Totally disagree
about
that.
But this is a case where the characters are, like I said, standing against a wall. It was like looking at a page, and from a cinematic standpoint, that's not interesting to me.
See, for me, it totally worked. And I think it created a completely different reality that, flat or not, three-dimensional or not, that didn't bother me. I don't play video games. I know they exist. I know these things exist, but and I know that comparison has been made to this film, and honestly, it was a fear of mine going in based on the trailer. I didn't feel that way at all, not once. And I do think that Rodriguez was, as we talked about 2 years ago, way too awestruck, I think, by Frank Miller's original work, and didn't find the need not only to improve it cinematically, but to improve the sort of, you know, characterizations at all. I found that film, I know I talked a lot about, and you referenced this in your intro, that I was offended by its kind of misogyny, but ultimately that film bored me. And it really was cinematically boring to me, visually not interesting. This film is about battle scenes, and the thing about violence on film in general is that I think most people are lazy with it. It's not that I'm offended by violence, it's that I'm frequently bored by it because it's over-edited. This film, I think Snyder takes a lot of care in terms of capturing the momentum of each and every battle, giving me a sense of where things are at a macro level and also on a micro level. Every moment of those battle scenes was interesting to watch for me.
No, I think after a while, despite the fact that they keep adding new kind of magical villains and creatures for them to fight, I don't think they really up the ante. I think after a while, the scenes become sort of interchangeable. And I can already predict the emails that are going to come in and tell me that I'm probably taking it a little too seriously and asking for some kind of real narrative structure to a film because it's just, you know, about entertainment. But beyond simply being, you know, blood and gore entertainment, the fact is that, as I said, this movie is about storytelling. It takes too much care in setting up the legend of Leonidas, which I like, and introducing us to his family and showing us the Spartan way of life. And it all sets that up. And then I don't think it pays off at all, because literally you get to a point in the middle of the film, and if we were watching it right now, I could pinpoint exactly when it is for you, where it becomes just battle scene after battle scene, and we lose that narrative.
That's the story.
Structure.
That's the story of the film. That's a story that's being told. That's the myth that's being built. And I totally think what I really like about what Snyder's done, I think reading the original graphic novel, Frank Miller strikes me as someone that is in a kind of awe of the Spartan way of life, maybe a little too in awe of it. I mean, this is not exactly a democracy. These are the kind of people that would toss aside any child that was deformed at birth, as we learn in the film. This is a cruel society based on building a great military. I think Frank Miller kind of gets off on that a little bit. On the masculinity of that.
Sure.
Certainly this film adaptation is all about, you know, masculine strength and celebrating that. But I think Zack Snyder, all he sees is a great story. I don't think he's really trying to celebrate or isn't really in awe of this ideology in some way. And I think that's why it works. And I think it's a story about a great battle. And I think it doesn't try to be any more than that. And again, I think my fear going in was that, oh, great, you've got the West, Greece, martial Greece, Sparta, fighting the East in Persia. Not a really particularly, or it is rather a particularly sensitive issue here, you know, in the world today. And I was a little worried that that would be dealt with insensitively. But I thought really what Snyder does with the script isn't simplify things. I mean, in terms of the way the Persians are depicted, that could easily reflect a kind of corporate culture that we live in. This the West of the luxury, you know, the luxury of the West. And I applaud it for that. It's not like he's saying there's this equation that, you know, Sparta is the West, is the U.S.
No.
Persia is. And again, but at the same time, I can see with this whole thing about freedom and democracy and justice, these words that have been kind of vilified or taken over by the Conservative Party in this country, I can see the misunderstanding there, that it is a sort of, you know, conservative rallying cry. And I really think it's not that.
I don't think the fact that Zack Snyder chooses to do that or not do that has any bearing on whether or not the film is good or not, frankly. And I just feel like by the end of it, you know, I'm surprised at the fact that you could sit here and tell me that besides being just generally excited and having the adrenaline flowing through some of those scenes, that by the end of it, you're going to tell me that you were actually in some way inspired by it. Did you ever feel like you wanted to jump out of your seat and pick up a shield? And I think the movie wants you to do that. And I think the answer resounding no.
I would absolutely say yes to that. Yeah, Adam, more than that, I was actually just really excited to talk about this movie. Like, I walked out of this movie just excited about the experience. Did I want to pick up a sword and a shield and join the Spartan army? No. I mean, no, I can't imagine.
Well, then you're missing, I think, a larger point of what he's getting at, because if you reduce the film, as you basically did, to just being about a great battle, then you're basically overlooking all of the other aspects of the film, including the bookended frame, which is a significant part.
No, I'm not. I don't think it just focuses on the battle. I think it could do more. I do agree with you. I think it could do more with the storytelling structure that it sets up, but I still think the movie is successful in putting on screen the story, the myth of this great battle. That was exciting for me to watch.
I'm so happy for you.
I've used that line before.
I know. I had to bring it back.
All right. Well, if you've seen 300, and I know so many of you have, and you agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. We've become a race of peeping Toms. What people ought to do is get outside their own house and look in for a change. Your top five movies about voyeurism are up next in listener feedback. Stay with us.
The king's taken back the throne. The useless see the sun. When they say they're cutting off the throne, but tell them you're not home. No place to hide. You're fighting as a soldier on their side. You're still a soldier in your mind, still nothing's on the line.
Hey guys, it's Mark in Atlanta. I hope this message finds you well. I just wanted to drop a line about the movie 300. Me and a bunch of buddies went and saw it this weekend, and we all loved it. Best movies I've seen in a while. I don't have a single complaint about it. Kind of curious why the movie came out in March and not a summer release date. But with the big numbers it pulled in, it was definitely great, and be interested to see what you guys had to think about it.
Hey guys, this is Mark calling from Dallas, Texas. I'm just getting into the podcast here, becoming addicted to them, actually. I thought it had one of the best trailers I've ever seen. I think the trailer actually grossed $70 million over the opening weekend. The movie didn't. The second week, it'll find out how the movie actually does. I thought it was very disappointing. I thought some of the visuals were very impressive, but the stuff surrounding it just seemed like it was Gladiator, it was Braveheart, it was the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Everything was so serious and self-important. And the battle sequences at first were good, but then they got kind of repetitive. The technique seemed to be slow motion, regular speed, slow motion, regular speed. And I don't know, for a two-hour running time, there was chunks of it where I was really bored.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and there you have it. The listener onslaught has already begun. We already have a battle, Sam, among our listeners.
I can't wait.
Sharing our battle.
You're Persia, I'm Sparta, Adam.
That's it. That's it. Oh, you get to be Sparta?
I get to be Sparta. You and all the rest of the highfalutin critics are... You know, taking this movie apart, calling it a video game, blah, blah, blah.
We're going to be the effeminate Persians. That's how you're going to cast
right.
us.
That's right. You're an 8-foot-tall effeminate Persian, and I am King Leonidas. That's right.
Oh, you want to be King Leonidas so
badly.
I knew it.
You should see my abs now.
I know.
Massive.
I bet. Well, anyway, thanks again for the voicemails there from the two Marks. And we want to get on to our poll question from last week that does tie in with 300. And unfortunately, Sam, I think you are going to have a lot of support. The question was, we posed to you, the creators of Dawn of the Dead 2004 and Sin City are behind 300. You're like, I'll be there in loincloth and armor. CGI isn't really my bag, but I'm curious. Or looks like my version of hell. Sam, how did it come out?
Well, it turns out about 80% of respondees, of listeners, were at least curious about this film. 47%, they'll be there in loincloth and armor. I saw a few of them at my screening. 31% said CGI isn't really my bag, but I'm curious. And only 22% said it looks like their version of hell, which actually, now that I think about it, is kind of high. Although, like I said,
it is.
A good portion, obviously, very interested in this film.
Yeah. How is Carrie dealing with the fact that you're carrying a shield around the house?
Yeah, exactly. I just walk around in a tunic and my underwear, really.
Well, maybe she appreciates that.
She absolutely loves it.
It's a nice visual image for all our listeners there. A quick note we wanted to mention. We've been dealing with our top five movies. We're most embarrassed to admit we've never seen a top five list from a couple weeks ago. And Sam, you emailed me a note. Several listeners said, Adam, if you're going to see Lawrence of Arabia, you have to at least see it on the big screen.
Right.
And as it turns out, Sam,
Lawrence
of Arabia is coming to the big screen. The Time Cinema in
Milwaukee.
The land of the Van Halgrens, Milwaukee.
The land of milk and cheese.
August 18th. Through the 20th.
That's right.
And so I think the Kempinars may have to make a trip up to Casa de Van Halgren.
Right.
And I actually am thinking, Sam, that maybe Sarah and I go see the movie and we leave Holden and Sophie and the newborn with you.
That's right.
What do you think
have
of that?
Newborn about, what, 2 months in, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And the movie's about 24 hours long, so really it'll be a full day I get with the young Kempinar kids.
There you go. So are you in?
Will
you babysit?
I'm in. It's sold. It's on the calendar.
I don't know, though. You might subject my son to 300, and then who knows?
That's right.
And speaking of that, and you mentioning how long Lawrence of Arabia is, I actually think it's like 36 hours is the full
cut. Oh, that's true. It's true. It gets longer with every show,
We did get an email, something we want to clarify. Evan Sweeney wrote in and said that he thinks Lawrence of Arabia is one of the greatest films of all time, and that he was never bored by it, and he's kind of shocked to hear us talk about how, even jokingly, we want to see a cut-down version of it. He says the length of films have never bothered him. Two of his favorite films are even longer than 3 hours, Magnolia and Gone with the Wind. We just want to clarify in case there was any confusion out there. We have no problem with long movies.
No.
Sam, you love Fanny and Alexander. I love Godfather.
Magnolia,
and The Godfather.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and Magnolia and The Godfather Part 2. Our point was simply just in terms of trying to find time for movies that you've missed and that you really want to catch up on, juggling those films with family and film spotting and work and everything else we do, it's nice to have a good 85-minute movie sometimes. And
Dr. Caligari, for instance.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Whereas trying to sit down to make the time for Lawrence of Arabia is just hard. We have no problem with the length of the film, and we just wanted to clarify that. And also mention that one of our listeners, Sarah Staggs in Chicago, wrote in, Sam, and she wasn't alone in suggesting that people would like to hear us talk about these movies that are on this top five embarrassed list.
Right.
And we are considering what Sarah and others have suggested, which is that maybe in between our marathons we'll take a few minutes to discuss some of these movies.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. And I've suggested to you another sort of way to break up the marathons is dealing with the Up series.
Mm-hmm.
13, 7 Up, 14 Up, and another marathon recommendation that's been recommended to us. It's also been recommended to us that we don't do it all in a row, watch them back to back. They were meant to be seen 7 years apart, and maybe doing them 6 weeks apart would be an interesting way to do it. So a couple things we're thinking about.
We are definitely thinking about that. And one other quick programming note before we get on to the mailbag and your feedback is I wanted to mention a couple of interviews coming up on actually next week's show. You'll hear my conversation with Scott Frank, the writer and director of The Lookout, and two of the movie's stars, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, one of the guys we love, as you know, from Brick and Mysterious Skin, and also actor Matthew Good, who was in Match Point.
Right.
He's in The Lookout as well. You'll hear that interview on our next show. And also in April, on our Chicago Public Radio show at the end of the month. You're going to hear my interview with the guys from Hot Fuzz. I'm going to get a chance to talk to Simon Pegg and Nick Frost and Edgar Wright, and I'm obviously really looking forward to that, and I know many of our listeners will be as well.
And me too, yeah.
Let's get on to the mailbag then, Sam. Last week on the show, we talked about the Oscar-winning foreign language film The Lives of Others and got a few responses here that are worth sharing. Let's start with Paul Melton.
Paul Melton wrote, "I just want to give you my opinion as to why Lives of Others won over Pan's Labyrinth. The endings," Paul writes. "The ending of Del Toro's film is uncompromisingly brutal but ultimately perfect. In its last 30 minutes of epilogues, Lives of Others devolves into a tautly woven, exquisite human drama into the kind of mawkish, middle-brow, beat your audience over the head with your message and make good in the end tripe that Hollywood loves and for which Spielberg is adored." It was hard for me to read that, Adam.
I bet.
I couldn't disagree more. I mean,
I know.
I can see maybe having a problem with some of the very last moments of small problem. Mm-hmm. But really, to chalk up the last 40 minutes to, as Paul does, beat your audience over the head with your message and make good in the end. I mean, I feel like that is such a gross mischaracterization of The Lives of Others. I want to think that maybe Paul saw a different film.
Well, I don't think it's a gross mischaracterization, but I do think he went too far with it in terms of his characterization. I don't ultimately agree, though, as I said on the show, I did have some reservations about the way the film wound up. And one of the reasons I did think Pan's Labyrinth was a better film, and I know you disagree, is because of the ending.
Yeah.
So on that, I am in agreement with Paul. And actually, I do want to point out that there has been a discussion in our message boards. There's a spoiler forum at filmspotting.net/boards. And I have been kind of dealing with some of the issues in terms of my own internal dialogue I had about the ending of The Lives of Others. And some listeners, or at least one listener, Phil, wrote in. I think I actually have worked out some of my problems with
it.
But it actually opened up a few other questions in the process. So there's a lot to really get into with the film. And if you want to head over and get into it some more and kind of get a feel for what I was suggesting last week during our review about the things I couldn't give away because I didn't want to spoil anything, but why the ending didn't quite work for me, you can go over to the boards and maybe get into that a little bit more. We also got an email here from Jared Wilson, who wrote in and said, "Going into the Oscars, I was rooting for Pan's Labyrinth and a Paul Greengrass upset for director. Like many, I'm sure, I found it strange when, after already winning two Oscars, Pan's Labyrinth was not the name they called when they opened up the envelope for Best Foreign Language Film. Instead, it was The Lives of Others. My heart sank, but only for a moment, because then I thought to myself, well, I guess I need to see that one. Fast forward to today, and I go down to Denver to catch The Lives of Others at one of the local art houses, and I absolutely loved it. The only film I saw this year that was more perfect was United 93. But Lives, despite an awkward but necessary fast-forwarding over the last 10 minutes, so again, Jared even has a little bit of an issue with the ending. He says, Lives just gets it right. I found it moving me to reflect on my closest guy friendships and the performance, the lead performance. Sam, do you want to say the actor's name,
Ulrich
please?
Ulrich Mühe, I think.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thanks again to, we have to thank Marcus Kruger from Germany for sending us
pronunciation.
He says his performance is way up there with Whitaker and Gosling's Dare Anyone Say Better. And he asked us, will The Proposition and Fast Food Nation fall off our list of the 10 best of 2006? It did for you.
Yes,
you answered that question.
Yeah, it really did. Yeah, as I noted, Lives of Others is really at number two best films of the year for 2006.
Yeah, and I didn't have it quite that high, but in looking at that question that way, I would have to say that it would be right up there with The Proposition in terms of like my number 10 film. It might make the list. I did like it that much, and I do want to say that because in the fact that I ripped on the movie a little bit for some of its shortcomings, I want to make it very clear in case anyone missed it that I really liked the film a lot. I think it's a fantastic movie. So that's some feedback on The Lives of Others. And we have a little bit of top five voyeurism feedback, Sam. Let's get to some of this here. Why don't we start with Jonathan Metz from Boulder, Colorado. We did do our top five movies about voyeurism, about being watched, being surveilled, tying in with The Lives of Others.
Yeah, Jonathan writes, Sam and Adam, I'm really shocked by your top five list for the voyeurism category, especially Sam's choice of 2001, which was my number one choice. Kind of slipped it in there. 2001, which is certainly a masterpiece, Jonathan writes, but has little to do with voyeurism. Hal is an active participant on the ship, basically another member of the crew. Other than the one lip-reading scene that Sam mentioned, this film has nothing to do with voyeurism. I think that scene alone was enough for me, honestly. Here is Jonathan's list with short explanations. Number five, American Beauty. This entire film, Jonathan says, turns the viewer into a kind of voyeur, deriving entertainment from watching this family fall apart in many intimate ways. Number four, Eyes Wide Shut. Kubrick's last film was all about watching others being watched, being suspicious, and the consequences related to these situations. Number three, Rear Window. Number two, Adam.
Yeah.
What Women Want.
I've seen it.
Number two.
Tragically.
You may laugh at this choice, Jonathan writes, but Mel Gibson's character becomes the ultimate voyeur by gaining the ability to hear women's thoughts without their knowledge or permission.
Yes, Jonathan, but you're saying it's a better film than Rear Window, Eyes Wide Shut, or American Beauty?
Ouch. That's on the record, buddy. Okay, and Number one, he has The Truman Show, which wouldn't have appeared really on either of our lists, but when you get to the next segment of the show, you realize why it was absent from our
list. That's right. Yeah, he has a nice comment. He says, there's no better film about people watching people and why they feel compelled to do so. Obviously, I think Rear Window, my number one, would maybe be a better candidate for that. But still, a great email from Jonathan. And I want to mention, I think I forgot Eyes Wide Shut. I forgot Cachet.
I did too.
I forgot some movies. Eyes Wide Shut is a perfect candidate.
Choice.
Absolutely. And a film we've both been on record as saying that we like.
Yeah, almost makes up for the fact that he had What Women Want as number two.
Yeah,
almost.
It does, which I did see and really found pretty dreadful, unfortunately. So let's read this one here, and maybe we can get to some more in the top five segment. But I wanted to close, Sam, with this email from Nico in L.A. and Santa Barbara. The one film I was waiting for either of you to mention is Peeping Tom, Michael Powell, 1960. This is a classic film that has been used as primary material with others like Vertigo and Rear Window in the study of the male gaze and voyeurism in film studies. If you haven't seen it, you need to go and rent it right now. This would have been the most obvious choice for me, and Sam, I think it would have been the most obvious choice for us as well.
Yeah.
I said to you literally right before we started recording, how great is it that we're doing a top five list that deals with Peeping Toms without the movie
Neither
Peeping Tom?
Neither of us having seen it. Yikes.
Unfortunately, we haven't seen it, but it is definitely on the list. We knew someone would call us out on it.
Well, it's to give a reason for Nico in Los Angeles to write to us. That's why.
There you go.
You were provoked, and yeah, we got what we wanted.
Well, let's close out actually here with the last one I want to read. Jose, our friend who seems to be appearing in the show a lot lately from Portugal.
El Duderino, Portugal.
Not from El Duderino. His top five, because it's an interesting list. He's got number five, The Truman Show. Number four, Breaking the Waves, a great movie. Number three, Another Woman. And then his top two are Cachet and Rear Window, which were on our list. But Another Woman, the Woody Allen film, Woody sort of doing Bergman, his kind of female version of Wild Strawberries. That's a great film that I completely
forgot.
Huge
miss on my part. I looked at like a napkin I had on my kitchen table. I had written Another Woman, don't forget, top five voyeurs. Didn't bring the napkin.
Didn't
follow through on that. And Jose also writes he wanted to put Phone Booth in there somewhere just to hear me call his list alternative, but it didn't fit.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. He didn't make room for that either.
Well, it's a Joel Schumacher film, so really it
exactly.
can't really fit on
Joel
this
Schumacher.
List, unfortunately. All right, if you've got feedback for us, again, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or give us a call at 206-203-2463.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Jim Carrey's ad-libs make us look bad. And we continue our silent movie marathon with a film that is 2 hours shorter and 99% less racist than Birth of a Nation. Stay with us.
Where's there to go?
Fiji.
Where the hell is Fiji? Near Florida?
See here?
Yeah.
This is us. And all the way around here, Fiji. You can't get any further away before you start coming back.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I destroy a beloved screenplay and you get a shot at a free DVD. Last week, we massacred the scene you just heard from Peter Weir's The Truman Show with Jim Carrey, a tie-in with last week's top five movies about voyeurs. Of course, as several of you pointed out, we said Australia in our version when it should have been Fiji, and that's what happens when you have the script. But don't listen to the scene before performing it. It's something we will never do again, Adam. Is that true?
We will never do again. I'm vowing here and now.
All right, we'll reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Mark Larson in Utah, and I guess now Brother Scott no longer has the sole Larson bragging rights to Massacre
right,
Theater here
Mark
on Film
Larson,
Spotting.
Right.
because Mark has won as well. Congratulations. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
Ta-tay-tee-toe-too.
No, no, Miss Lamont. Round tones, round tones. Now let me hear you read your line.
We're on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, tying in with our top five battle scenes, and we decided, Sam, we would try to mix it up a little bit. You had this brilliant brainstorm that we should try to go back to something we did almost 2 years ago on the show, which is the Google Translator version of Massacre Theater. So this is where we've taken a scene, run it through the translator. What language were you using here, Sam?
Japanese.
Okay, so it's actually in English, of course, then put into Japanese, then retranslated back into English. We thought it would make a scene that is otherwise probably very easy to figure out a little more difficult. So we're going to give it a shot.
All right.
Okay, and you start it off. I will give you the action. And action.
I become corrupted, but I am the person who thinks of the graver of your surface glance from my ones. The sun, we must have the alliance with blank, which wins here. It achieved that. Your land, your family, which increases, was rescued. At time, it possesses all powers of blank.
Land, title, person, power, what?
What?
I the possession do not do at all. Depending upon the person because of me, because if those are thrown from my land to which I fight separated, I have their wives and their children be hungry. It fought for those people, and blank, who bled the red of the land with Falkirk, as for him, I having never, and without being fights, because some. And as for me, his, I, who take that betrayed him, and it pulls the battlefield, which looked from at that of my surface the time, and that from me separated, has torn.
It is good. All people betray. Everything loses the center.
I do not think that we would like to lose the center. I him the way think that we would like to believe. As for me, on reverse side, for the second time, never there will continue to be.
And scene. I love it.
I don't
People
know, Sam.
Stopped listening 45 seconds ago.
I know. I still wasn't on board initially, but I don't know. I think that was actually pretty fun.
That's pretty fun. We'll find out if listeners agreed.
Yeah, if you can actually pick out what movie we just massacred, send us an email by Tuesday, March 21st. Feedback at filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's show. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net. Sam, is it okay that I broke character there? I just couldn't help
a little bit. I noticed. You fell a little flat in the back half there, but I think this is what iPods are for, right? You can go back and listen. There are clues embedded within.
There definitely are a lot of blanks in that one as well, because otherwise it would still be even too obvious. So anyway, that's Massacre Theater. And Sam, let's get on to our marathon movie this week. Before we get on to The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, though, we do want to share some thoughts on last week's controversial discussion of Birth of a Nation. Got some interesting feedback here. We want to share two emails that kind of set up perfectly the dichotomy of responses you could have to this film.
Right. Well, this one's from Seth in Fort Lewis, Washington, who writes, "Wow. Well, guys, I suppose you were more able to separate your moral sensibilities from your film critical faculties than I was. I remember seeing Birth of a Nation in college for a film studies class. My buddy and I sat through about 45 minutes or an hour of this splenetic, foul piece of work, and I remember that my sense of moral disgust was so strong that I found myself hating the film on a technical level as well. Although I can recognize on a historical level that this film was the first to put together certain elements and it had essentially created the feature film, I was so turned against the film because of its content that all I could see was how primitive it was. I saw the clunkiness of certain aspects of the editing. I think this film preceded the development of things like the 180-degree rule and continuity of eyelines, and I found the intertitles laughably melodramatic. After a while, my buddy and I had had enough, so we left to go see Ken Russell's The Devils at another screen on campus, an even more over-the-top film, but one that I was much more able to enjoy since it mocked rather than sentimentalized mobthink and prejudice. I've walked out of several films out of boredom or impatience, but Birth of a Nation is the only film I've ever walked out of because of content. Ick, Seth writes. Yeah. Well, we can certainly understand that response, but I bet if Seth went back and checked it out, I mean, maybe knowing what he was getting into, I don't know how much he knew ahead of time in terms of what the experience would be like, I bet he'd see, would be more impressed maybe by at least technically what Griffith is able to accomplish with that film.
he might. And I think a good response to here, an answer to Seth's, comes from Eric Christensen here, who writes in and says, well, you made brief mention of her work, but it was the first thing I thought of as you got into the question of whether you can divorce craft from content. He's talking about Leni Riefenstahl. Mm-hmm. I agree entirely that you can, yet some films, particularly where we are aware of their subsequent impact, make it a deeply unsettling experience. A couple of years ago, I watched Riefenstahl's 1935 Triumph of the Will with a room full of theologians and film buffs, and we were, every one of us, mesmerized. You have little choice but to admire her directorial choices, some of which I will probably never forget, such as the shadow of Hitler's plane descending over Nuremberg, or shots from behind his car just above his head as he passes through the streets, capturing the sheer joy of the crowds. Of course, almost every scene is infused with a tragic irony, which also makes the viewing oddly memorable. So you have convinced me. I must now put my copy of Birth of a Nation, which has sat on my shelf for about 3 years, bravely into the VCR, and brace myself. Keep up the great work, Eric, and thank you for the great response, yeah. Eric. And again, I think a response to Seth's, where you can appreciate the film on the level of what Griffith is achieving technically. And one of our listeners on our message boards, Sean, has been having a dialogue with other listeners, including myself, about the fact that he's seen a lot of Griffith stuff, and he is suggesting mm-hmm. that if you go back and look at Griffith's short films preceding Birth of a Nation, he's using a lot of the same pioneering techniques, which right. makes Birth of a Nation somehow less revolutionary. And while that may be true, the fact is, in terms of the impact Birth of a Nation had and putting all those techniques together in one film on a feature film level, that's where the legacy, I think, of Birth of a Nation comes from. And I don't think you can just choose to overlook that simply because of the fact that you don't agree with its content. If you did, you would also be overlooking films like Leni Riefenstahl's films, which sure. he's mentioned, which Eric mentioned. I've seen both of them, and they are masterworks of documentary, despite the fact that you're watching a lot of glorious shots of Hitler. It's mm-hmm. tough to sit through, but is it worth sitting through? Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think, too, we're at risk of sounding like we're just talking about Birth of a Nation as an achievement of some sorts.
Mm-hmm.
I genuinely found it thrilling to watch, exciting. I mean, I'm not comparing it to other films of its time. I'm comparing it to Zodiac or other films that we're seeing now. It's that thrilling. It was that compelling to watch, even over a 3-hour span, and even despite its horrifying content. So yeah, just last words on Birth of a Nation there.
Okay, well, I would say I do want to make clear that I do disagree with you a little bit on that. I mean, certainly in relation to a film like Zodiac, I found more exciting and would much rather sit through Zodiac again, certainly, than Birth of a Nation, content or not. That's just the way I feel about it. I think I do respect the film as more of an achievement, whereas you admitted you were genuinely caught up in the story. I was less so, but still a film I'm glad I finally saw and did enjoy watching, despite the repulsion of having to sit through some of those scenes, without a doubt.
That's music from Robert Wiene's 1919 German Expressionist classic, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, the story of the madman Dr. Caligari, who sets up camp at a street fair in the village of Hostenwald, where he shows off a subject, a sleepwalker named Cesar, who can tell the future, and who may also be responsible for a series of grisly murders that have been taking place in town. The movie's surrealist theatrical set and use of dramatic lighting are hallmarks of Expressionism, and they were the chief inspiration for the look of American film noir. But they were in part developed by cash-strapped German filmmakers who couldn't afford to stage the kind of spectacles that their American contemporaries, like D.W. Griffith, were producing. Adam, as we just discussed, Birth of a Nation, which we discussed last week, serious moral shortcomings, but there is a reason why we're still talking about this film nearly 100 years after it plays in theaters. And I don't know about you, but watching that film did get me excited about the strengths of silent movie making. It got me really excited to see Dr. Caligari. Was it an improvement on Birth of a Nation? What'd you think about it?
I don't know if you can say improvement. I think the movies are very hard to compare, though there is an obvious correlation that you touched on, in that clearly these German Expressionist films were direct responses to a film like Birth of a Nation. They simply could not compete in post-World War I Germany economically right. with the kind of things Griffith was doing on that kind of a canvas, with those huge battle scenes and the dramatic tracking shots and all those extras. They couldn't compete. They had to find a way to make the films visually interesting to look at, and they mm-hmm. did it, of course, with, you know, the lopsided doorways and the alleyways and the lights painted on the sets, and the Expressionist style was born out of that economic need and that mm-hmm. economic reality. And I think it's interesting that the film, I don't know if I would go so far as to call it coincidence spotting, but there's a definite connection with the movie we reviewed, 300, and this happens sometimes on the show, in that first of all, both stories are essentially flashbacks. They're framed by a present-day narrator recounting the tale that, you know, we see unfold. Caligari was a pioneer in that respect. It's one of the first movies to ever use that framing device. And then, of course, you have the style of it. This expressionist style certainly was a precursor in some ways for the look of the graphic novel, and you're watching a film with this hyper-realism, and it's all about the style over the substance. And so watching the film, I enjoyed it more, actually, as a story than Birth of a Nation. As an achievement, not as much. But just as a story, being caught up in this murder mystery and watching this film that's a precursor for every film noir and every horror film that was really ever made, I was caught up into the story, you know, more than I was with Birth of a Nation.
Sure, yeah. I mean, absolutely. Something like Birth of a Nation almost keeps you from being able to enjoy the story based on the content. And certainly this is a more interesting and in some ways, at this point, familiar story in some way. There were a number of kind of familiar feelings of it. Sure. You almost feel like if it wasn't made, you know, 80 years ago or plus, you would be like, oh, it's totally ripping off everything I've ever seen. You know, not only the sort of framework, which I think was actually added on in terms of the bookend.
It was.
Because it was seen as a criticism of the Weimar, of the reigning power in Germany. So you can, knowing that, you can kind of see that. It seems kind of tacked on. And the story itself, just, you know, the madman and, you know, nobody, you know, where they're trying to get to the bottom of these murders. I mean, it recalls something we just talked about not too long ago either, something like Perfume.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and your criticism of that film is just like, why don't they go after the kind of crazy new guy and his crazy sleepwalker? You know,
right.
It seems
we have all
kind
these
of
murders.
Obvious. But I guess I found it disappointing, ultimately, to watch this film after Birth of a Nation, because Birth of a Nation made me realize what was so exciting about silent filmmaking in its reliance on telling a story visually. I think, honestly, Birth of a Nation, 3 hours long, had probably a third fewer title cards than the 82-minute Dr. Caligari. Weirdly, I found Dr. Caligari talky for a silent film. Like, it wanted to explain so much. How many scenes were there of people just talking on screen?
Yeah.
And then we would see their dialogue on the title card. That wasn't really that interesting after the sort of visual excitement of Birth of a Nation. So I found it slightly disappointing, but still, as you said, pretty striking to see visually.
You know, I think that's a really interesting point. In some ways, despite its expressionist style and despite the influence that, as we talked about, Birth of a Nation apparently had on classic Hollywood cinema, in some ways, Dr. Caligari almost feels more like a modern film.
Yeah.
It feels more like a talky film, a movie that needs dialogue, whereas Birth of a Nation, you can rely more on just the visuals to tell the story. I think that's a really fascinating point. And I don't want to use this as a crutch, and I hope it doesn't come up too often, you know, throughout these marathons, but I felt something with this film, watching it, that I had with the movie Playtime, Jacques Tati's film that we discussed briefly on 848 here on Chicago Public Radio, and that is that watching a film like this, unfortunately having to do these marathons where we're not able to see these movies in a theater, I'm watching it at home on my 27-inch television screen, I feel like watching a German expressionist film like that, you are just really losing a lot, because there's this psychological and symbolic aspect to what you're seeing, in addition to it just kind of trying to dazzle you, and you can literally shape the background to match and reflect someone's mindset, and you're watching all of these scenes and the intricacy of these sets, and I'm trying to watch it, and I know that I am missing so much. I'm missing the detail, and I'm not able to fully appreciate it on the spectacle level that the filmmakers clearly wanted you to appreciate it on. And so I feel like, in some way, I was missing out on that aspect of it, and I regret that, even though, like I said, I was still very much caught up in the story. And I definitely love seeing the fact that this guy, Cesari, the somnambulist, the killer, he's Edward Scissorhands, right?
I was going to say, this is Tim Burton. This is a Tim Burton. I can't believe Tim Burton hasn't remade Dr. Caligari, because Johnny Depp has already been casting the original. It's uncanny.
Literally, the first time you see Edward Scissorhands, you now know where it comes from. It's the first shot of seeing Cesari. So, you know, too, you mentioned briefly that the ending, unfortunately, the tacked-on ending of it, you know, this is a movie where, you're right, it's funny to bring to it your modern perspective, where you've seen all these films that follow these similar kind of storylines. Who are they going to believe? Is the person in authority really a bad guy or not? And you start imposing what you expect from these genres onto it. And then you get to the ending, and then you realize that they do try to soften it, unfortunately, and they make it less subversive, which is unfortunate. Certainly, I think the movie has more power if it played it straight rather than having to go back and add that framing device.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, but when you have the government, you probably have a gun to your head if you're a filmmaker. If you're Robert Vina, it's different than, you know, trying to get a PG-13 rating nowadays.
True.
It's a little bit different. All right, well, next week we'll take a look at Russian master Sergei Eisenstein's battleship Potemkin. For the complete marathon lineup, visit filmspotting.net and click on the marathon's link.
In this next week, Sam, I hope you're going to be boning up on your understanding of montage.
No doubt about it. Mise-en-scène, pal. Yeah.
We're going to take one last quick break. When we return, Sam and I pit 300's Battle of Thermopylae against some of our favorite on-screen battles. Stay with us.
Let's take a look at what's new on DVD, brought to you by PureFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at PureFlix.com.
Coming out this Tuesday, Sam, here it is, The Blood Diamond, two-disc special edition. If you've been reading the dope sheet, you know this may be the biggest fight ever in the history of film spotting. Though it actually suggests that I loved the film, and I didn't even really like it. I just liked it, but you hated it so much.
You had to defend it, yeah.
I had to defend it. We ended up arguing about it quite a bit. It is out now in a special edition. I know Edward Zwick probably does a commentary on it. Sam, you're going to listen to that repeatedly, right?
Oh, absolutely, really. I mean, I think my whole concept of film derives from now my thoughts on Blood Diamond.
Fantastic. All right, look forward to that. Also out, Come Early Morning, Joey Lauren Adams directing Ashley Judd in that film. The Nativity Story, apparently Catherine Hardwicke got her DGA card back from Sam.
Good for her.
And Rocky Balboa, the sixth and final, hopefully, installment in the Rocky franchise.
We have to see this, don't we, Adam?
Now we have to see it, you're right. And finally, worth mentioning, Anchor Bay's version of Reanimator, a film that was part of our horror movies marathon, a movie we both had a lot of fun with.
All right, well, let's take a minute to thank a few people who went to the filmspotting.net site and donated a little bit of their hard-earned money, and those people are Greg, Catastrophe Apex, Tony, The Bulwark, Conundrum, Melinda, 100 Minions Later, and Jason, The Clarity of Vindictiveness. They all went, like I said, to filmspotting.net and donated a little bit of their money. We thank them for that, Adam. There's a weight that's pressing down.
Late at night, you can hear the sound. His name? Kurt Thomas. His title? 3-time world gymnastics champion. His assignment? A secret mission for the United States government. His only weapon? Himself. And that's all he needs. Combine the discipline, the timing, and the power of gymnastics with the explosive force of karate, and a new, all-powerful martial art is born. Gymkata.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and before we get to the top five, we have to acknowledge that great clip you just heard, the trailer from the epic Gymkata, a film that I think was kind of crowned the number one film during our top five So Bad It's Good list several months ago. But we want to thank Mike Spring, the editor of DVDsnapshot.com, for sending us a copy of Gymkata, and I haven't
finally
seen it
available
since I was
on DVD. Yeah.
I know, finally available on DVD. Haven't seen it since my junior high days. I can't wait to jump in and check that out. Sadly, Sam, I don't think it's going to make our top five battle scenes.
No, you don't think so? Pommel horses?
No, despite
the pommel horse battle, not impressive.
Yeah, despite its infusion of gymnastics and karate, I don't think it's going to make our list, sadly.
Oh, so. Parmistan, wait for another top five.
Maybe someday. Okay, well, it is our top five time, obviously tying in with the movie 300, our top five battle scenes. And I will say that this, for me, is sort of the Empire Strikes Back, Battle of Hoth memorial list.
Okay.
I think in terms of what I think about my youth and getting excited by a battle scene, nothing tops the Battle of Hoth from Empire Strikes Back, but it's penalty boxed. I'm not going to use it. So, Sam, how did you form your list, and what is your number five?
This story shall the good man teach his son. and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
How can you totally lose all credibility with everyone who loved your review of 300? How can you do this?
To name my top, my number five greatest battle scene in film history as the Battle of Agincourt in
Shakespeare.
in Kenneth Branagh's Henry V. Again, technically, probably not a great achievement as certainly anything in 300 or anything else that'll appear on my list. But sometimes great battles are preceded by even greater speeches. And the St. Crispin's Day speech delivered by Kenneth Branagh as Henry V makes this battle work, makes this battle an inclusion on my top five.
Okay, well, you know I love Henry V. It's the reason, literally pretty much the sole reason, I became an English major in college, and yet I find it totally preposterous that you put it on this list. So
that's a great, like, 14-minute battle scene.
I know. I want to get that on the record, though.
All right, fair
enough. Okay, well, for me, this was tough because I did consider movies like The Dirty Dozen and The Big Red One and, of course, Kubrick's Paths of Glory. You got the original All Quiet on the Western Front, some of these older films, but for me, none of those had battle scenes that were as vivid in my mind as some of the ones I'm going to mention here that are, for the most part, more recent films. Mm-hmm. And number five is a little bit of a surprise, certainly not a classic, a movie I liked but didn't love, but Enemy at the Gates, a film that came out, I think, 4 years ago with Jude Law and Ed Harris. There is an opening battle scene, this epic battle scene, the Battle of Stalingrad, and it's late 1942. Stalingrad is about to fall. The Communist Army's morale is as low as it could possibly be, and you've got the German soldiers, which are, you know, they're better trained, better equipped, and they've got a full army. It's kind of like the Persian army battling the Spartans in 300.
Right.
And the thing that sticks out in my mind, the reason I'll never forget this battle scene, is tying in a little bit with Paths of Glory, is you've got a case where the Red Army, you've got all these soldiers seeing that they're facing their death, unlike the Spartans who are looking forward to dying and dying with honor. They don't want to die, and as this boat is coming into Stalingrad here, people want to jump off. They don't want to go into battle, and the Red Army, their leaders, are shooting them, saying, of course, if you're not going to fight, we are going to kill you. And there's one scene, too, where a guy has a pistol, and he's being ordered to go fight a tank, to go run at a tank. It's just crazy stuff, a really interesting, well-staged battle scene.
All right, good pick. All right, well, my number four, I know I'm going to make some people happy out there in film spotting land. I'm including a Lord of the Rings film on a top five list. This may be the first time ever. I think, and I know somebody's going to correct me here, but I'm pretty sure the battle I want to refer to is the Battle of Pelennor Fields from Return of the King, the third part of the trilogy. And I'm including it because I think it helped redeem the entire trilogy for me. I liked the first film quite a bit, The Fellowship. The Two Towers completely bored me. I had no interest in it. The third one started a little slow, and by the time it gets to this battle, the whole trilogy starts to make sense for me. It really just worked. It got me excited like I hadn't been excited since the first one. And I think it's just really well staged, like any good battle scene. You really get a sense of where everything's happening on a large level, and also it can follow all these individual battles and never loses any sense of momentum. And it's just exciting to watch as the stakes are raised. And so there it is, number four, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, the Battle of Pelennor Fields.
All right. I think Helm's Deep, the Battle of Helm's Deep from that trilogy, is another one that you find on a lot of...
I think, and that's in the first one, I believe,
Yeah, I think it's from the first one you find on a lot of top battle scenes lists. Well, you said it perfectly, even though I didn't like the choice. You said it well about Henry V, the fact that sometimes great battles are preceded by great speeches. And with that in mind, let's hear a clip from my number four.
They mean to take us as a prize. And we are worth more to them undamaged. Their greed will be their downfall. England is under threat of invasion. And though we be on the far side of the world, this ship is our home. This ship is England.
That's Russell Crowe as Captain Jack Aubrey in Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, directed by Peter Weir. And there are only two battle scenes in this movie. They frame the movie. And I think that Weir, and you just touched on this, Sam, he does an amazing job of showing the entire battle unfold, not just kind of the chaos, the internal chaos of it, and a lot of close-ups. You really see it happen, and the tactics and the strategy of naval battle without using kind of, as I said, this MTV-style cutting, just really perfectly staged. And I think that the setup to the battle, too, which we hear part of there in Crowe's speech, the whole aspect of the trickery they have to use, where they have to sneak behind that phantom French boat.
Yeah.
I love that. I even just love the idea of how they treat the boat as this phantom, this specter, because the fear of the unknown, of course, is worse than reality in some ways. The fact that we have to imagine how great this boat must be and how fierce of an opponent it's going to be. It's so great that we actually don't really get to ever meet their captain or
right.
hardly even see the boat. I love that idea. So for me, that's a film I really like and really remember distinctly those battle scenes.
It's a film I love too. I think it's a great pick. I wish I'd remembered it myself. All right, well, my number three is the battle scene, I think, of contemporary times, and it is the Omaha Beach battle scene from Saving Private Ryan. And really, has any battle scene really in the history of the film taken on this kind of cultural weight? When people talk about Saving Private Ryan, 99% of the time they're talking about the first 20 minutes of this
yeah.
film. It's number three on my list because largely because I have no intention of ever watching it again. I mean, there's something really rousing and thrilling and exciting about a lot of the battle scenes we've mentioned. Certainly, I would say in 300 that I wouldn't mind watching it again. I'm not sure I'll go out of my way to do that, but I certainly would. Saving Private Ryan, there's no pleasure in watching mm-hmm. that film. It's a great achievement. It's certainly memorable, but it's not something that demands revisiting, certainly for me.
Unlike 300, which rightly or wrongly feels a little bit like a video game. I mean, you'd agree that the violence is...
Let it go.
I'm saying simply, Sam, that the violence is fake. You can enjoy the violence.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's artifice. Yeah, absolutely.
It's artifice. Good point. Can't enjoy it that way in Saving Private Ryan.
Good point.
My number three is Black Hawk Down, directed by Ridley Scott. And I haven't seen the movie recently enough to really pick out specifically one battle. I know it's all one battle of Mogadishu, but they really do kind of break the battles up, and I don't know that I can pick out a specific sequence. I just think the whole film is pretty amazing. It's set in 1993. Army Rangers are sent in to capture a Somali warlord, and I think it's notable because it's, first of all, the rare war movie, I can't think of any off the top of my head, that takes place in an urban landscape, and I remember really being blown away by how Ridley Scott constantly reorients us by using aerial shots and wide shots to show us where the Rangers are, where the enemy is, where people are, where they're trying to get to. It's very meticulous as opposed to, as I said previously, just trying to capture the chaos of war and not knowing where you are at any time. You really always know where you are, and it's funny because I think Ridley Scott's committed those same sins in movies like Kingdom of Heaven and the opening scene of Gladiator, which is the reason why it doesn't appear on my list, but with Black Hawk Down, I think he really gets it right.
Well, it's so interesting. I think it's a great pick, and it's a great film, and it's a film in many ways. Like you said, it's the large part of it is the battle scene, and in many ways, the only thing that works in it is the battle scenes. I remember sort of the prelude when we're introduced to all the members of the Rangers there not being particularly good, but once that battle scene, the battle scenes or extended battle scene begins, that movie becomes unbelievably compelling. It's a great pick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, you just mentioned Kingdom of Heaven, but it's my number two, maybe because it's so recent and relatively memorable. But I think the reason I recommended that film at all was because of the last 30 minutes, the Siege of Jerusalem, that he depicts in vivid detail, really fascinating detail in terms of getting the sort of historical nature. I mean, what really was happening at that time, really educating you as he's depicting this really thrilling battle of Saladin's siege on Jerusalem. And it's another case where the film really didn't do anything for me. And, of course, I think we've both heard a lot about the fact that this film is improved greatly by Scott's extended director's cut, which
right.
When will I ever make the time for that? I don't know if I ever will, but I've heard it enough now where I'm certainly curious about it. But nothing can I can't imagine the last 30 minutes of this film being improved very much. I really
okay.
remember it being memorable.
Well, it is certainly true. You're right. We get so many emails about that apparently the director's cut of it really salvages the film and really makes it work. And so I am curious, too. I don't know when I'd ever find time.
Apparently
but
it solves the problem
curious.
Of Orlando Bloom's miscasting as well.
Wow, really? I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
That'd be fantastic. Well, let's go ahead and hear a clip from my number two. Should be obvious. The first sound you hear. Of course, the Ride of the Valkyries sequence from Apocalypse Now starts with the absurdity of Robert Duvall talking to Sam Bottoms about his surfboard, this great tracking shot you get across the village with the school, the serenity of that scene, the school children. in that courtyard sequence, the serenity of that juxtaposed against the helicopters coming, so many different angles Coppola uses, the shots, Martin Sheen's stoic look through it all is just fantastic to watch. He's just totally unimpressed and unamused throughout the whole thing. And then there is the exhilaration of just hearing the music and watching them blow stuff up, as sad as it may be. There is an exhilaration there, and it's certainly, again, we comment on this all the time, but one of the few things we liked about the movie Jarhead, the Sam Mendes film, is the scene where you watch them relive that moment, or they watch that film to try to get them ready and pumped up for war, and you can certainly see how it would have that effect. It's my number two.
Good pick. Well, you made it your honorary Battle of the Ice Planet Hoth list.
Oh, wow.
I made it my number one. I think it's in your penalty box and maybe not mine. I hope I'm not betraying the list. Yeah, I mean, nostalgia is choosing this one, certainly. I haven't seen it in years. But when I thought of battle scenes, it was one of the first things that came to my mind. Just the X-Wing fighter. I think Luke, you know, is somehow entangles one of the AT-ATs with this kind of wire mechanism.
Yep.
Thrilling, just thinking about it right now.
His harpoons,
now.
His torpedo.
That torpedo. That's right, the harpoons. Yeah. And I think it must be in the first 20 minutes of the film.
It
because
is, yeah.
As I think I've related on the show, when I saw it when I was 6 years old with my dad, once we got to the planet Dagobah,
yes.
Of course I made my dad pull me out of the theater and take me home because it was much
too
scary. So I know I saw at six the Battle of the Ice Planet Hoth, but not the rest of the film until I was about 20 years old. So it's vivid in my memory.
A great scene. And before we start getting emails from all the Star Wars people, I do want to say you can actually watch the entire 12-minute sequence of Hoth on YouTube.
I'm going
and
to
I
do
watched
that.
It the other day
wow.
in preparation for this list.
Oh.
And I actually don't think they're flying X-Wing fighters.
Oh, you're
they're
really?
Flying,
oh.
No, they're flying some kind of different ship. And I don't know. I'm not okay. enough of a Star Wars geek, I'm afraid, to know what they're called. But I had the same vision you did of them flying X-Wing fighters, and I was proved wrong by that. But it probably would be my number one as well. Like I said, I put it in the penalty box there because Star Wars for me is kind of off limits, which brings me to my number one, and it was for you, your number three. It's Saving Private Ryan, a film I've been critical of on the show. I think it's highly overrated, actually, but I don't think that opening 20 minutes at all is overrated. And I think all battle scenes in some way up to this point have felt cinematic. They felt like I know I'm watching a movie and there's a distance from it. And this is the first time where I felt like I was in the battle and I wanted it to stop. The handheld camera, the sound design where you go under the water with the soldiers who are dying, the blood stains on the camera, the blood spatter. It's a 20-minute, you know, assault on the senses, and it's glorious and horrifying at the same time. Like you don't really want to go back and ever relive it despite the technical achievement of it. So for me, when I think of battle scenes, that is the first one that comes to mind. It's my number one.
All right, well, that is our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
Opening and wide release this weekend, Dead Silence and Chris Rock's I Think I Love My Wife, which is actually, I believe, a remake, an update of Chloe in the Afternoon from Eric Romare. And if you go to our marathons page, you'll see that Romare is going to be part of our next marathon on the show. But we're not going to see that film, nor are we going to see Dead Silence or Sandra Bullock in Premonition, despite the fact that it looks kind of eerily similar to
Your
the
favorite
Lake House.
Film of 2006.
Yeah, exactly. One
House.
Of my favorite films. But next week, we're going to skip all those. We're going to see the brand new film from Mike Binder, Sam's favorite director, Rain Over Me, starring Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle.
Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. You can also sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. Distributed through the Public Radio Exchange, Film Spotting is available for broadcast on your local public radio station. Information is available on our website, filmspotting.net.
Thanks to Arcade Fire and Merge Records for today's music. Learn more at mergerecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by the new PeerFlix. Discover, trade, connect at PeerFlix.com.